Well, welcome back to another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix. Glad you could join me today. Got a terrific show lined up for you. Arturis Karnisovas is one of the most fascinating people in basketball right now. He's had a long career. He's currently the general manager of the Denver Nuggets. Before that, he was a decorated player at Seton Hall, came over from Lithuania, didn't speak much English, played the 1992 Olympics, went up against the Dream Team, so he's got a lot of great stories, and he shares a few of them with us over the next 45 minutes or so. So stick around right now, the Vertical Podcast with Arturis Karnisovas. My guest this week is Arturis Karnisovas, the general manager of the Denver Nuggets. Arturis, thanks for joining me here.
Thanks for having me.
So you were recently promoted to the GM job in Denver. When you think back to where you started, you know, growing up in Lithuania, going to Seton Hall, how is it surprising to you that you're here right now in this job, you know, doing what you're doing?
Well, it's been a journey. I've been in basketball all my life, but I never could have imagined that I'm going to end up where I am today. And I'm very fortunate to be in this position. So, I mean, being an 18-year-old, Lithuanian kid that didn't speak any English, came here and played for Seton Hall and, you know, and got an education and then played pro overseas. I mean, it's been a long journey.
When you were growing up, was playing professionally always the dream?
I grew up around basketball. Grew up in a country that the basketball is number one sport by a mile. And my father played, so I've been in gyms and locker rooms around, ball bouncing all the time. So, it's been a blast.
Was your father influential in pushing you towards basketball?
Well, you didn't have to push. I mean, the country is surrounded by basketball, and you know, if you were a boy, you want to be a basketball player. Mm-hmm. So, I've dreamed, and very early, I figured out that basketball could be something that I will do because I was pretty successful in youth categories and start playing well very early. So.
You were you mentioned Seton Hall, and now Seton Hall has had its ups and downs. But back when you went there, PJ Carlissimo coaching that team, that was a strong program back then. How did you get connected to Seton Hall?
Well, I played for at that time for a junior Soviet team that came to the States to play like 11 games, friendly games with like high school all stars. And we did like exhibition 11 games, and I think that's where he saw me. I watched Seton Hall in Final Four in 88-89 campaign. That's how I remember the actual school. And the fact also was that it was hard to imagine that I'm gonna go to college, because there was never a Soviet athlete that actually went to college in the States. So it was something unheard of. So it was a long process. I finally got there. It's actually a long story. Long story from, KGB history and, being the first one to show the way for other, athletes. That you can play sport and get an education. That was new.
When you decided to go play at Seton Hall, was it difficult to, I don't know what you needed. Do you need permission to go? Did you need to? How did you get over there?
So, I was 18. So, I was young, and a lot of times I was ignorant. During this process, it was...
We all are to some degree.
Yeah. So... I had to, I think, with the team that I was coming, we were going to play exhibition games, and I was going to stay. It was unheard of. It's like defecting, So I spent 3 days in Moscow literally waiting for the decision. They're going to let me go, or they're going to send me somewhere. So it took them 3 days to make a decision, and they decided to, allow me to go. because right before that, there was a decision of Šarūnas Marčiulionis going to Golden State. And it was the same situation where, you know, somebody up there decided to let him or allow him to go and play professionally in the States. So he went to play pro and I went to play college.
How big a star was Marčiulionis back in those days?
Well, they were, you know, he was huge. I mean, I think Sabonis and Marčiulionis, they were two biggest stars, and, you know, in our country. Athletes that every kid growing up and playing basketball looked up to. So I got a chance to play for the team that Šarūnas played, and he, like, took me under his wing and, you know, showed me the ropes. And I think I started when I was 16, mm-hmm. playing with men. So,
if they didn't let you go and play at Seton Hall, where do you think your career would have gone?
I think I would have stayed locally, and I would play for two local teams that, you know, that, again, every kid wants to play. At that time was a Soviet Union championship, so I would have probably just stayed locally. And that's when the time around in 1989 when they were allowing athletes to go and play already pro in Germany, in Spain, so the gate opened at that time. So I think I would have probably also somewhere in Europe.
Going to Seton Hall, clearly you wanted to do it, but not speaking English, going over to play in a foreign country. I mean, what was the early days of that experience like?
Well, it was hard. I think the first year was just, there were no cell phones. So I would write letters, to my parents, to my friends, wait for the letters to come back, sometimes get on the phone and be fortunate. I stayed with the family in Oakhurst, New Jersey, with Vida and Ivo. First year was probably most difficult because I was away from home. I mean, and it took, I think, for me, 3 years to actually come back to Lithuania because of, you know, what was happening, the freedom, and, you know, while it was Soviet Union, they were pursuing me to go to army and threatened me to put me in jail and all this stuff. So, it's been, and also my freshman year, actually, that's when the war actually started with Kuwait, so that was interesting, you know. So there were a lot of things going on the first 2 years.
So did they want you to come back and you said join the army and be part of that?
They were sending letters to my parents and saying that, you know, if your son is not going to go to army, we're going to put him in jail for you. So I was afraid to actually come back. And in 1992, Lithuania was already free, and for the first time we put together a national team to compete in 92 Olympics, that was the first time I came back. And it was like this, you know, hurt puppy, you know, walking around in Lithuania, and, you know, are they going to take me away somewhere, you know? So it was very emotional.
Did your family ever come visit you when you were in New Jersey at Seton Hall?
Yeah, they did. My father came, and it was interesting times because there also was a bunch of demonstrations, Lithuania free now in D.C., in New York, at the same time trying to play basketball and, a lot of memories during that time. So a lot of stuff I didn't realize until now. A lot of people were telling me stories, even how I was enrolled in Seton Hall, you know, when at that time, you know, how they accepted me and took a chance at me by not knowing, you know, what grades I had, I'm so appreciative now to know all that stuff later on to be then, you know, Big E Scholar, the year two times in a row, and play pretty well for them.
So. When you come over to a major college program like that, I mean, without speaking English, what tactics do you use to learn English? I mean, what's your...
Well, they took a lot of classes that didn't count for my graduation, so I took it as a second language. Mm-hmm. But I literally walked in an American history class, and I couldn't... So I was struggling to take notes, and I just felt embarrassed. So I said, I will never feel like this again. So for first year, most of my classes were math, because, you know, the education in Lithuania, you know, was pretty strong, so I can survive on math and calculus, and until they told me I cannot take any more classes. I have to major in math.
You got to be the only student I know that wanted to take more math classes, I got to tell you.
It was easy for me. So, but it took me a year probably to be proficient, and then I took, you know, English 1 and English 2. Didn't have to struggle later on. So,
and all the while you're playing for PJ there. I mean, what was that experience like?
Well, it was great because all I cared is obviously to play and to play minutes. You know, it was great to play for PJ because I started pretty much every game. He trusted me from freshman year. Actually, we played our freshman year against UNLV in Seattle in the Final Eight for them to make it to Final Four. So it's interesting to sit here and see the banner of 1991 that they went to Final Four. But so, you know, playing for PJ, and now you know he's around, you know, USA Basketball, and has been coaching obviously in the NBA for a long time, and him being a broadcaster, seeing him on the sidelines, so it's fun.
Was the college game a big adjustment, you know, playing US brand basketball?
It was. Actually, I tell these funny stories because, you know, they use this basketball element as a Euro step right now, you know, from, you know, James and Dwayne Wade that took over, and they weren't calling travel. When we came in the early 90s, that was a traveling call given, you know, so I stopped doing it. So now it's an element that, you know, they came up with, and it's very effective in transition and when players drive.
So you had the Euro step in your game, but just took it out. Because,
well, in Europe, it's called just the step.
Steps. It's like Chinese food in China.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's something that you work on, you know, when you go through player development, through, you know, high school, and it's something that they teach you. Mm-hmm. It's Euro step. It's basically change directions from one side to another.
And the college lifestyle?
I enjoyed college life. You know, I guess it's easier to get used to something when you come to, obviously, the States. You know, listening to people that come from Lithuania and go to a supermarket and they see, you know, food sections and the choices that they have. And, you know, they cry in food sections, you know, seeing, oh, there's so many choices of cheese and meat and, you know, and bread. It's wonderful. But I was, you know, remembering that standing in line for toilet paper, you know, in old Soviet Union, you know. So those were the times. So for me to adjust and come to, you know, to experience college life, everything was a wonderful experience.
And you got a chance in 92 to play for the Lithuanian national team, going back, playing for that team. What was that experience like for you to be a part of the Lithuanian national team?
Well, it was, you know, huge honor, and but it took us a long time to get where we got in the Olympics because we had to qualify. So it was a qualifying tournament in Spain, and we had to play like 11 games to qualify for 92 Olympics, and it was unbelievable experience with all that group being together for 2 months, inseparable, and then travel to Barcelona and to win a bronze medal for the country that just got their freedom. It was special.
The 92 Olympics is best known around here for the first time the USA basketball team was put together with pros, the Dream Team. Seeing them out there, you know, going up against them, I mean, what was that like for you?
Well, you know, after my sophomore year, you know, I was a young kid and playing against, you know, players that you watched on the video and you were looking up to. It was great. And then the obviously other special thing is that PJ was assistant coach for that team and was on the sidelines. So, you know, at that time, you know, we played the dream team and I was like shooting free throw and, you know, looking on the sideline and PJ's like, you know, smirking at me. I think it was one of the special memories that I have from that game. So.
Were they, I mean, when you look back at Barcelona, were they almost larger than life over there with the big names, the Birds, the Magics, the huge personalities? I mean, how big was that USA team during the 92 Olympics?
Well, for us, I mean, the separation in terms of basketball was so huge at that time in terms of, you know, how much better they were than the rest of the world. So in order, you know, we lost by, you know, 45 or 50 points. I mean, that's given. However, it was a huge, you know, honor to get on the floor with those guys and, you know, and see what we can do. Obviously, we didn't do much, but, but you know, our most important game was obviously for the bronze, where we played unified team. And at that time, you know, ex Soviet team. So, you know, to win a medal for that was my most special probably moment in my career.
Did you have a good moment against the USA team? Was there a I crossed up Chris Mullen, I took it into against Magic?
Well, I had to guard Barkley. It wasn't fun, you know. So, you know, I was kind of, you know, obviously undersized, this skinny dude trying to guard Barkley. And I fouled out. So basically what it was, you know, when you're overmatched physically, you know, I fouled out with a couple of minutes to go in the game.
Arturis, hang on for just a second. I've got to tell my audience about something that I hate to do, and that's shaving. I'm not a big fan of shaving. I wish I could go through life unshaven, 5 o'clock shadow every single day. But for various reasons, I have to shave a little bit more often, I should say. And the secret to that is The Art of Shaving, founded in New York in 1996. The Art of Shaving has been helping guys look their best for over 20 years. The Art of Shaving has your total routine covered, whether shaving, beard maintenance, hair, skin, body, or fragrance, you name it, they've got it. The Art of Shaving's award-winning products are formulated with the highest quality botanical ingredients featuring pure essential oils. The four elements of the perfect shave have been created to deliver smooth results every single day. You finish off the perfect shave with one of their five fragrances, Sandalwood Cypress, Velveteer Citron, I prefer Green Lavender, a whole bunch more. Each cologne has been carefully assembled for a distinctive scent. The Art of Shaving offers a convenient replenishment service that allows you to save on your favorite products while never having to worry. Here's how you get it. Our listeners will receive 15% off their first order and free shipping, great deal, by using the promo code MANIX. To get this offer, go online to theartofshaving.com, use my special promo code MANIX to get 15% off your first order and free shipping. Visit theartofshaving.com for the special offer, or for a consultation with a grooming expert, step into one of their many retail locations near you.
The 92 team in the Olympics was considered by a lot of people as kind of a moment that changed international basketball when that team sort of burst onto the international stage. I think everybody saw how good they were and everybody started to try to compete after that. I mean, and the gap closed over the next 10 years. The gap closed considerably with Argentina and other countries playing well. What do you think was that a big moment for international basketball in terms of sort of exploding the game, seeing these guys and how great they were?
I'm not sure. I think it just kind of triggered something in international basketball. There was also more movement in terms of players were coming to play to NBA. There were more and more players coming from Europe and from, you know, Latin America to play in the league. It's almost like a new revolution in terms of basketball. You know, they were moving towards, I think, what, around 2000, 2002 is when U.S. finally lost. Mm-hmm. 2000 was, you know, Olympics in Sydney. when Lithuania was very close and had a last shot at the buzzer to possibly beat U.S., which wasn't imaginable in 1992. So the gap closed like in a matter of like 8 years. Mm-hmm. And we start saying that nowadays everybody can play basketball in any country. So
could you feel, and you also played in 96 for the Lithuanian team. Could mm-hmm. you feel any difference in just those 4 years passing, or was it still not quite, were they still not quite starting to catch up at that point?
Well, again, Lithuania was proud of losing to U.S. by the smallest margin, which was 20 points.
And so the gap did close a little bit there.
Did close. It wasn't 50, it was 20 now. So, but it was a different feel. It was a different feel. It was, you get an, maybe in the next 4 years, somebody will get closer. But we did feel that we competed better. We knew more. And we took another step towards, getting closer to the U.S.
Where do you keep those bronze medals?
After a long time keeping in a drawer, my wife kind of framed them. And
smart woman, you gotta
exactly, and took all my medals and framed for me. So that was one of the gifts. So they at home.
When your playing career ended, when did the idea of coming back to the U.S., working for the NBA, being involved with the NBA, when did that start to form in your mind?
I started forming that idea probably when I was 30. I didn't want to be a 40-year-old player that's trying to figure it out what he wants to do with his career. And at 40, it's kind of late to start something new. And you're not as flexible anymore. You get set in your own ways. And for me, it was a necessity. So when I turned 31 and I retired from FC Barcelona, that was my last year, my son was born in Barcelona as well. So I wanted to go in the financial world and kind of help athletes after their careers to stay, to save their money and to be successful. So I started working for a financial firm at that time called Asante. So it's like a business management firm. Originally came from Canada, was acquiring agencies and, buying out business, buying businesses. And so I spent a year on client, development side. And after a year, I got an offer to join NBA office. That was the time of, the number of players start getting bigger in the league, and Kim Bahuni that always worked with Stu Jackson basketball operations, and she had this international department. She kind of offered me a job and opportunity there, and it was a necessary evil for me. First, I wanted to be close to basketball. Second, I wanted to to work at one point, for the franchise. And it took me 5 years, that I spent in a league office. And thankfully enough, I had to, it was a boot camp for me of business of basketball. You constantly overworked, but, writing reports and, and doing weekly updates and constantly in the meetings figuring out, it's literally like a setup of IBM and different departments, from marketing to doing events with different people. So for me, the experience and still keeping updated with federations, with FIBA relationships, it was huge experience for me.
It sounds like it was an around-the-clock type of job over there.
It was nonstop. it was, again, it was necessary for me. I got exposed to so many things, you know, from, you know, being around also lawyers and being around the cap. And there was a time that, you know, I wanted to make a jump and work for NBA team. Opportunity came in 2008 when I was able to do it with the Houston Rockets. And I was interviewed to join them, you know, in as a scout, and I took that opportunity.
And that's, I mean, the NBA, working in the office is a grind. I would imagine being an international scout is as big a grind, if not more, because, you know, knowing what I know about these guys, the life on the road is pretty nonstop as well.
Well, life as a scout is obviously a lot of travel. However, you know, when I joined Houston, I was exposed to a lot of things, you know, not only international scouting, but also college and NBA, NBA games, being involved. Inclusivity was one of the things that I appreciate from, you know, Daryl Morey and Gerson, that, you know, in that time, actually Sam Hinkie was also, you know, executive and with the Rockets. Inclusivity was, you included in all decision-making. And getting experience, you know, being in the draft room, being around trade deadline, and being around free agency. So you'll learn a lot of things and pretty quickly. So, you know, as, you know, every year would improve, and, you know, they would give me more and more responsibility. So got to the point, you know, I was, you know, director of scouting for the Rockets and running, you know, pre-draft workouts and being more and more involved with them.
Every GM is different. They all have their own different philosophies on how to build a team. Mm-hmm. Working in Houston under Daryl, one of the more aggressive general managers I know, always looking, never in the mood to rebuild, always trying to stay above 500 in contention. What did you take away from that experience that stays with you?
Well, learning from that situation is that you can come up with 60, 80, 100 ideas, and one of them might stick. But it's a relentless try of trying to make things happen, you know, that I got from experience in Houston is that, you know, other teams, you know, they don't want to call and they don't want to kind of lose the negotiations by engaging teams. It was opposite, you know. They would... again, they would call every team and constantly and, you know, look for ideas how they can make their team better. And that's what I took, and still till this day, I also believe in, you know, come up with 100 ideas, maybe one will stick. Mm-hmm. So that's what I took from the Rockets.
Working in Denver, it seems like it's a similar type of atmosphere that, you know, Tim and Josh Kroenke, they seem like a very inclusive bunch that encourages that type of atmosphere.
Well, absolutely. You know, you're trying to develop your personnel as well, you know, by including them in, you know, decision making and, you know, ability to voice their opinions, even if they are the only ones that believe in it. You know, that can trigger ideas as well. So, you know, Tim has been you know, unbelievable also in this situation. And I think we work well together, complement each other. You know, he's, you know, savant, and he's a very good talent evaluator. And, you know, working together with him the last 4 years has been a blast.
He's also a huge fan of professional wrestling, you know.
WWE.
Major fan. It's almost a sickness.
I didn't know that.
Oh.
I didn't know that.
Ask him about the gorgeous ladies of wrestling. Glow, GLOW, sometime. You have to put aside half an hour because he'll talk to you about it.
Well, he's a very, very versatile person because he knows the news. He knows about basketball. He knows about different sports. He's very informative. So.
Tell me about the last few months have been like for you. dating back to last year, you were in the mix for the job in Brooklyn. You were part of the interview process in Milwaukee for their open GM job. You wind up staying in Denver with that promotion to general manager. What were the last few months like for you?
Well, it's been tough and it's been intense, you know, going through interview process with Milwaukee was exciting. At the same time, you know, it was kind of tough because of timing right before the draft. And, you know, Tim and the group was kind of leaving me out. It was getting a little bit awkward, but worked out that, you know, that Josh, you know, walked in and made an offer and, you know, my family was excited. I was excited to stay with Tim, to stay with the group, to stay with the franchise and Kroenke family, and I'm thankful.
What have you learned about the interview process over the last couple of years? I mean, it's not as simple as this guy's the right guy for the job. There are a lot of politics involved in all these, in different ways in all these teams.
Well, I'm sure it is, and each ownership looking for different things. I'm never trying to guess what they're looking for. I'm just trying to sell myself and my experiences and, you know, what I've been through and what I can offer them, and then see if that sticks, you know. And, you know, it's been a learning experience for me going through all these interviews, but and it's been a blast, and obviously I'm... just to be considered, it's an honor. So, you know, can't complain.
Do you have a general philosophy on the best way to build a team? I mean, you've worked for different people that have had different ideas. I mean, even in Houston, Daryl had one idea about how to build a team. Mm-hmm. Sam Henke took the job in Philly, did it a completely different way. In a general sense, what are your basically guiding principles to building an NBA team?
I think you take away from each situation certain things, but you build your own, you know, kind of world and how you would do things. You don't become them, people that you work for. I think you just take things away and, you know, apply it in your own setting. So I think I would be, you know, obviously different by doing things, but, you know, inclusivity for me is a huge thing. Is, you know, hiring you know, intelligent, passionate people, you know, it's another thing of mine. And, you know, just being fair with people and put them in a position to do their jobs, you know, not to, you know, micromanage them, you know. So it's just I think with personnel and surrounding yourself with people is the way you do with the players. You're trying to project what they're going to be in 2-3 years, and hopefully you select personnel that have a potential to be, you know, GMs also in the future. Mm-hmm. And you're going to help them to get there and then be proud when they, you know, obviously accomplish that. So
gets harder and harder to project players, doesn't it, with how young they are when they're coming to this league?
It is, but it's fun. And you know, you have your kind of database in your head and your mistakes and your successes, and you just take away from each situation and, you know, what I said wrong, or, you know, about the player that I said he's going to make it and he didn't. What were the reasons? You know, in success stories, you know, how, you know, there's a lot of luck obviously involved, and Tim and I admitted to that as, you know, all the time. Is, you know, you just make informative decisions and then hopefully that will stick, and, you know, the luck is part of it.
You stay in Denver and, you know, you go back to the team, and it's basically all out basketball war in the Western Conference right now. I mean, what's it like as an executive to be operating in a conference where you could build a team that wins 47-48 games, and that team might not make the playoffs in a conference that's as deep as I think it's ever been in its recent history?
Well, it's insane. I mean, we figured that out in, during the draft. You know, Minnesota's got Jimmy, and, OKC got, you know, Paul George, and now we got, you know, Paul Millsap. So each team is looking, you know, for for best player available and how they can make their team better and give them the best chance to win. And I think in the West now it's becoming more and more difficult to win games. And hopefully in the future, you know, we've had conversations with a lot of executives is that, you know, for the playoffs, they're going to take, you know, 16 best teams or 8 best teams in the West and do it that way.
Hang on for another minute, Arturis. I've got to tell my listeners about Quicken Loan and specifically Rocket Mortgage. Support for the Vertical Podcast comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. They understand that home plays a big role in your life and family. That's why they created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, with Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. It's convenient. Our trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage just at the touch of a button. And in addition to getting a real mortgage approval in minutes, you can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you're getting the right solution for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/Mannix, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Do you think that day is coming where we could see the NBA playoffs seeded 1-16? Because the argument against, obviously, from the NBA is that, oh, it's cyclical. It'll turn back around. But it hasn't turned back around in really more than 10 years. And if you look at some of these teams out there, yours included, it's going to be a while before the Eastern Conference catches up. Do you think that that's a realistic possibility that we could see 1-16 seeded in the playoffs?
Well, I hope so. Again, you know, I don't know the expectations now that the West is going to be, you know, brutally better than the East, but it happens, you know, every year that, you know, it's not as lopsided. So we'll find out, but hopefully in the future we'll see seeding and, you know, the best 16 teams.
I would think it's easier nowadays just because, I mean, you know, 20 years ago, teams were traveling commercial sometimes to get places. Now you're putting guys on private jets with catered meals on it. It's not as – it's still physically taxing if you have first round Miami against Portland for some reason, but less so maybe because of all the luxuries that players enjoy these days.
Well, especially like, you know, we in Denver, we centrally located, so for us to go anywhere as you know, the same time travel. So I don't think that would be logistically challenging. Mm-hmm. I think it's just that, you know, the idea of putting, you know, for playoffs, best 16 teams, that's the idea.
You guys were in a dogfight last year for that last playoff spot in the Western Conference. Portland winds up getting it, and they got it with a lot of help from a guy that was traded there, Yusuf Nurkic, mm-hmm. going from Denver to Portland. Did it sting at all watching Nurkic develop into that sort of center that Portland needed and certainly helped them get to where they got?
Well, it did. You know, it first I thought that, you know, 40 wins will be enough to make the playoffs, and, you know, Portland had other ideas, and Damian and CJ played at such a high level, and Nurk has been huge help for them to make that push for the playoffs. For sure, you know, it was disappointing because I thought it was great for our young core to experience playoffs, and especially feeling that, you know, we matched up so well with Golden State, just played them, you know, a couple of weeks before that and beat them at home. So kind of it would have been an exciting experience for our crew. To go through, because you know, there's not a lot of players, you know, on our team that have been in the playoffs and, you know what the winning is like.
People look at that deal and, you know, they say, oh man, they gave this guy away, but it was unrealistic to think that Nurkic and Jokic could, in other words, Nurkic would not have played as well as he played alongside Jokic. That just their skills, it seemed to me, just were too compatible. They were too similar in the way that they played the game. Putting him in Portland as a legitimate five opened things up for him, I would think, in ways that it could never have in Denver.
Well, I agree. I agree in that they're both, you know, great centers. It's just, you know, when we made that decision, you know, to start Nikola and, you know, December 15th, you know, since then, you know, for the rest of the season, we had the best offense, and we had to just roll with it. You know, we were, I think we were 29 and 22 since then. And again, Nurk is a starting five in our league. You know, it's hard to find players like that, 300 pounds, that move like a guard with the skill set that he has, you know. So it was, you know, it was a very difficult decision to make.
Jokic is a bona fide franchise player in this league, and you guys are beginning the process of building around his skills. But he was a guy that a lot of teams passed on, second-round draft pick. What did people miss about him that caused him to fall, do you think, to the second round?
Well, I think a lot of people had a hard time imagining him with lack of athleticism, how he would do in our league. I think that's the only thing. I mean, the skill set was very visible at that time, and he came to Hoop Summit. You know, it's, you know, he practiced and played the game. It's not like nobody saw him, and we saw something different. I think a lot of, you know, our group, we watched extensive tapes of Nikola, also watched extensive tapes of Marc Gasol when he was 19, and, you know, how his body looked and how his game translated into our league. So I think that was the main focus of ours. And, you know, taking a chance at, you know, 41 at Nikola was obviously a very small risk, but a very high reward.
Did he remind you of Marc Gasol from in the early days?
Well, I think just the awkwardness and, you know, not a great athlete, how does he make it in our league, you know? And and Mark was similar because he went through, you know, growing pains, obviously, you know, played high school in Memphis and then going back to Spain and playing there until, you know, until his most recent success in Girona and Barcelona, so before he made a jump to the NBA. So I think Nikola is the same way. I think just as, you know, how awkward he's physically, and, you know, but he gets the things done, and how skilled he is in a post, you know, an elbow, how he sees and passes and advances the ball. You know, I played with, you know, with Sabonis, who I thought was one of the best, you know, passing, you know, bigs, and I think Nikola surpassed him just because he can go coast to coast with that kind of skill. So we got lucky with that one.
I always thought that the American public missed out on seeing the best of Sabonis early in his career. He was a good player when he got to Portland and helpful to them towards the end, but he was something special in his prime.
Well, I think so. I think if in the 80s he would have made that jump, I think that would have been great, because he came to the league when he was 31, already had two Achilles injuries and knee, and just we saw, you know, Sabonis at the end of his career.
Mm-hmm. What's it like to see his son playing in the NBA?
Oh, it makes me feel old. You know, his son, you know, Dontas was born also in Portland. So, but I always was saying, you know, to Sabonis, you know, I watched you when I was a kid, you know, looking up to you. I played with you in the national team for 7 years, and then, you know, I actually retired and he was still playing for Portland. And I was like, dude, you know, you're playing for a very long time.
You guys, as I mentioned, you're trying to build the team around Jokic and find guys that played his strengths. You get a guy in Paul Millsap, who looks like is like the perfect fit alongside him, can space the floor a little bit, brings a different level of versatility. What was it that you liked about Millsap in that power forward role?
Well, it's very exciting, first of all, you know, to have him. And it seems, you know, that they're very complementary, each other. You know, you know, Paul can shoot from a three, he can pass, he's very skilled. At the same time, he's been, you know, four-time All-Star. and somebody that we, you know, didn't have in our locker room. And again, you know, you have a lot of young guys in that locker room, you know, from, you know, Jamal to Manuel, Gary's 22, Nicole's 21. So there's a lot of young players there, and they need that kind of guidance. And I think he's going to add a leadership role there besides his skill set. So I think we're going to be very versatile, you know, offensively. Again, to being very good offensively for the most of the year, we're going to have to figure it out defensively, schematically, and to be better.
You have to make the playoffs before you worry about who you beat in the playoffs. But as you're building a team, how much is the presence of Golden State on your mind, a team that's in its prime, that barring injury the next 4 or 5 years is probably going to be extraordinarily tough to beat?
It is discouraging, you know, kind of in a way. You think that this team might stay together for a long time, but we worry more about us now, and again, trying to get, you know, back to the playoffs and to get our fan base excited. And, you know, we got to have to take step by step. So we'll focus on us for now. Try to build a team that can get us back in the playoffs, and then you know, we'll figure it out the rest once we're there.
When you see Barkley, does he remember your defense from 92?
Probably not. No. Probably was easy. It's too easy.
Do you have any pictures of you playing against the Dream Team guys?
Yes, I do. And actually, in Lithuania, they made these booklets for school kids. With Olympic athletes on, you know, on the cover. And my kids actually have still a couple of them that is left over. And one of the pictures is me guarding Barkley. So I know he doesn't remember that, but, you know, it was a blast for me.
See, you got to blow that up and put it next to your medals there. You got to have a little wall. I mean,
well, I have a photo of actually jumping and trying to block Barkley. And I always say, you know, that actually happened. So I have a photo.
What was the end result of that play?
I don't even remember. It was a blur.
You know? Did you get a block?
It was a
in
long night. It was a long night for us. So, you know, and probably I'm the guy that is well known, you know, after I fouled out, sitting on the sidelines taking pictures of Dream Team. So that's.
Were you actually taking pictures on the sideline?
Yes. You know, it's you know, you're looking at those athletes that, you know, you were as a kid watching, and, you know, that's the reason why you're playing basketball. And so I was sitting, you know, and, you know, nobody's taking pictures, and I'm, you know, sitting on the sideline, actually on the floor next to the next to the bench, you know, taking pictures.
Oh, well, Arturis, thanks for doing this, yeah. And congratulations on all your success.
I appreciate it.
Best of luck with Denver this year, and I hope you get a little bit of rest this summer. It's been a crazy offseason so far.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Arturis Karnisyevas for joining the show. As always, you can download archived episodes on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it, and I'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.